This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
If I'd been there, I would have certainly been fighting tooth and nail to save Chatham Docks, because it's an area I understand a little bit better than many others. And that's the sort of thing I'd like to see more in local government, so that people can see someone there who they respect for their background, whether it's private or public sector, they respect for their skills, their achievements, and that these people are putting everything they can into making the area better.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week when Medway residents were up in arms over plans for hundreds of homes, fears were raised over antisocial behaviour in Herne Bay, and Kent Online's blue badge battle took a considerable step forward. I'm senior news editor Nikki White, standing in for regular host Simon Finlay, who is away this week. And I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Daniel Lesson, who covers borough and district councils in the county.
Hello.
We're also joined by senior editor Matt Ramsden with some news about a new columnist on Kent Online.
Hello.
This week's special guest is former Medway Conservative councillor Stuart Tranter, who has drawn from his political and business background to come up with some proposals on how he thinks local government should be run. He'll be speaking to Dan a little later on. So, Rob, what have you been looking at in Medway this week?
So, house building on the Hoo Peninsula is always a particularly contentious topic, but this week one village has been coordinating a response to a public consultation about a possible 350 homes on the south side of All Hallows. The village currently has just under 700 households already, but locals say the infrastructure already can't cope.
What sorts of issues are they particularly focused on?
There are the standard ones that come up all the time for the peninsula, which is that there's one road on and one road off, and that it's not particularly well maintained. Particularly the further out you go. But what came up regularly was the regularity of power cuts, which residents say are daily occurrences, and the almost entire dependence on cars, as buses only come once every 2 hours. One resident we spoke with said people assume that villages are full of wealthy people in expensive houses, but the reality at All Hallows is very different, and they said they just don't know how the village could cope if it grew by half.
So what's being done in relation to this consultation?
Responses are going in until June 15th, after which Catesby Estates, who are looking at getting planning permission for the scheme, intend to put in an outline planning application. From what I understand, they will have a lot of responses to go through, and they're likely to be quite detailed, as local ward councillor Chris Spalding has said residents should engage with the consultation and make clear everything the village is lacking and what it would need to cope with these new homes. There is a hope that outlining all the issues might put off Catesby Estates, or they would make a scheme which doesn't address the issues and therefore is unpassable when it comes before Medway Council.
Thanks, Robert. So what have you been working on this week, Dan?
So I've actually been covering the lead-up to a public meeting organised by local councillor about antisocial behaviour in Herne Bay, which is set to happen in the next couple of weeks.
What's pushed them to that?
So Councillor Liz Harvey has organised this meeting for June 23rd, and she tells me basically she's been wanting to do this for some time after regularly seeing and hearing from residents that they face harassment and trouble from a particular group of local youth. They said there's a couple of distinct groups of kids often seen wearing balaclavas and riding bikes or e-scooters who cause plenty of grief for residents and businesses alike. And she even told me that some elderly residents in one area in particular have told her they're so scared of facing harassment from these children, they actually avoid going out sometimes if they think they're in the neighbourhood.
And what does she hope to come out of this meeting?
So I've been told all residents and businesses are welcome, and Kent Police are sending a representative. So the hope is that the local community can agree on a way of working with each other and with the cops to both deter antisocial behaviour and make the regular culprits face starker consequences from the law for causing trouble. Last year, Kent Police told me they were going to step up their patrols in the area due to an increase in violent crime in the town centre. So maybe they still have some resources to spare for less violent but nonetheless disruptive antisocial behaviour.
So Nikki, what have you been working on this week?
Well, all the talk will be about Chancellor Rachel Reeves' spending review, which will set out the budgets for all the government departments over the next few years. Now, Miss Reeves was just wrapping up her speech in the House of Commons as we came in to record this week's podcast, and no doubt there'll be plenty of views on what was announced coming out in the coming days. The headlines will probably focus on her announcement to end the use of hotels to house asylum seekers, with funding provided to cut the asylum backlog. There's also going to be an extra £29 billion a year for the day-to-day running of the health service, and £39 billion to build more social and affordable housing. Now, the government had already made a partial U-turn over winter fuel payments and says that more than three quarters of pensioners will now get that grant. And there's been good news for families too, as from September, free school meals will be expanded to 500,000 children. And that's for the parents of their parents who are receiving universal credit regardless of their income.
That's big money. It's obviously going to affect us all in one way or another. So it'll be interesting to see what people have to say. Is there anything else at Parliament that caught your eye?
Yeah, I'm going to shamelessly pat ourselves on the back this week and particularly praise reporter Ellie Hodgson for the role she's played in getting every MP in Kent to back Kent Online's campaign to change the blue badge system. Now, listeners will recall back in March, we launched the blue badge battle, and we're trying to get changes brought in to help those who, at the moment, don't qualify for a blue badge when they probably really deserve one. Now, as you no doubt know, a badge allows people with mobility issues to park closer to their destination, whether they're a passenger or a driver, and that will usually mean a designated on-street parking bay, or badge holders can also park on single or double yellow lines for up to 3 hours. Private car parks are covered by separate rules. However, those applying for the badge at the moment also have to prove that their condition is likely to last about 3 years, and that's not always the case. It's almost as if some people are being punished for advances in medicine and making a speedy recovery.
3 years is quite a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, some people might only need help for a year or two. And after hearing stories from some of our readers who are living with things like cancer and other life-limiting conditions, Ellie took up their cause. We had Maidstone MP Helen Grant, Chatham and Aylesford MP Tris Osborne, and Mike Martin, who represent Tunbridge Wells. They were the first to lend their support. But we now have all the county's MPs have signed a letter calling for a temporary parking concession to be made available for patients who do not currently meet the three-year eligibility criteria for a blue badge. The campaign's also supported by the Shadow Secretary of State for Transport, Gareth Bacon, and the Chairperson of the Transport Select Committee, Ruth Gadbury.
Obviously, that's brilliant news. So what's the next step?
Well, we've had a letter that's gone off to the leader of Kent County Council, Lyndon Kemp-Caron, and that's urging the authority to lead by example and establish a fair and compassionate local policy that provides blue badge-style support for residents with cancer or other serious but time-limited conditions. A similar letter is also in its way to Medway Council, and that they look after the blue badge applications in the Medway towns. In addition, those behind the campaign are calling on the government to bring forward secondary legislation that would help patients right across the UK, so we'll keep you posted on that. So welcome, Matt, and you've got news of our new Kent Online columnist.
Yeah, I have indeed, Nikki. Thank you very much. This week we launched the KCC Insider, which we're hoping is going to get a lot of interest across Kent.
So who is that and what's the thinking behind it?
Well, the thinking behind it is that since Reform took over KCC at the May election, we've been having regular phone calls with people who work at County Hall and work for the County Council, talking about their concerns about work from home policies and the DOGE unit that went in there last week to find efficiencies. So we decided to launch a column based on the thoughts of an insider.
So the big question is, who is the KCC Insider?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not one I'm going to answer. Obviously, there's a lot of sensitivities around the sort of thing they're going to be talking about. So we wouldn't identify them because they'll probably put their job at risk. But all I will say is they are very well placed in the organisation.
Thanks, Matt.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
So our guest now is a former mayor of Medway, former Tory councillor for Rochester West of 8 years, and a businessman of many more, Stuart Transit. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Firstly, just by way of background, how did you end up in politics and what did you do both before and after politics?
Well, my early career was in BT. I started off in engineering. I ended up the head of service marketing. And I think that's I had some great training there, and that's they sent me to places like Harvard where I was able to sort of learn a lot about strategies and so on. I then ran my own businesses from the early 90s, understandably in the marketing and technology worlds. But as I approached sort of retirement age, my wife said, you need to do more in the local community. So, of course, being me, I kind of went slightly overboard with it and became very interested. I was unhappy with the way Mark Reckless resigned, and I think that prompted me at that time to become more involved. But of course, that's history, and he had his reasons. And then I, you know, became a councillor, and soon after that was mayor.
So you sent us a little article you had written basically outlining sort of in broad terms problems with the structure of local government, why it doesn't seem to deliver public services efficiently and that kind of thing. Just for the benefit of listeners, could you give us a quick outline of that? Why is local government in such a mess?
Yes, and of course it's a very complicated question. Going back a step, when I went into all of this, I was really interested to find out, although I'm trained to look at businesses and industries, it was more difficult to try and figure out what makes a borough or an area or a town or a city effective. And over time, with the council, I was really trying to fish to see, well, what are the core problems here? Because they're all evident to people. There's never enough money. People, whatever the priority is of the local authority, somebody else has a different priority. They are constrained by the laws. Most of their money is mandatory, the way it has to be spent, for example, social services. All this is known to people. So I tried to figure out, why isn't it local government is not getting more investment? And I think fundamentally, governments of all colours don't trust local government enough. And they probably don't trust them because there aren't the skills within local government to be able to make the big decisions, for example, to grow the economy. And I therefore looked at, you know, when I looked around me at my colleagues, lovely people, and from all parties, I might add, I'm not being party political here. There are lovely people in all parties. There's one or two you look at and you think, I'm not sure why you're here, but that's life. But there were very few that stood out. And then when you put the constraints around them, they're unable to progress and to make the real big changes. And they're just ordinary people from ordinary walks of life. And that's how we've set it up. I think now, I think the heart of my argument is we need far fewer councillors and possibly to attract people who have other commitments in life, families, careers, skills, and so on. We need to be able to pay them more and perhaps attract people, have a far fewer number, I suggest in somewhere like Medway, 7 or 8, to attract people who have specialist skills in an area and for them to be elected on that basis.
One thing I know that you don't point out in your analysis of problem with local councils is that, and I hope you might acknowledge that this is a big part of the problem, is that surely when your party, the Tories, were in charge of the economy for 15 years, yeah, at national level, they cut local government funding absolutely to the bone by more than 25% in absolute terms. You think that's not had any impact on the way local government runs?
No, of course, everything does. And I don't think there's ever been a moment in history when any local government, or any public service for that matter, is saying, oh, we've got more than enough money to do everything that we'd like to be able to do. And the last government, I'm not going to defend them at the moment because everyone, you know, this is not the nature of this today. But it was an incredibly difficult time from the start, right through to COVID and then war in Europe and so on. They had a lot of challenges. Whoever was in charge was going to find it a challenge. I would say that the cuts to local government are more nuanced than you suggest. In fact, it was a changing shape of how it was funded. And I'm not defending it, but I don't think it's the figures are quite, when you add them all up, as bad as you suggest. But that's a moot point.
So one of the other things you've written that's sort of implicit in what you said is that there's a lack of this expertise in the public sector. The right kind of people aren't working for councils, the right kind of people aren't standing for elections to councils, and you seem to sort of venerate the supposed dynamism and expertise of the private sector. But surely one of the biggest trends in the use of public sector money in recent decades is that the state, both local and national, spends eye-watering sums of money on outsourcing things to the private sector, on private sector consultants to tell it how to run public services, and yet still we're in this complete mess. Surely if the private sector had all the solutions to local government's problems, they would have found it by now because we've been throwing public money at them.
I'm not saying that this is something that the private sector has got all the answers to. That's not what I said. although it is fair to say it's not dissimilar to the way effective businesses are run. And if we had a group of people, some of them, for example, if we had a specialist counsellor who had expertise in healthcare, they're very likely to have come from the public sector. So I'm really not saying that everything's got to be private sector. And I think that would be a misrepresentation of my thoughts and ideas there.
I think a lot of people will probably hear that you want to reduce, you know, if Medway has 59 councillors, reduce that to sort of less than 10. I think a lot of people would probably support that, maybe because they think their councillors aren't very effective. But in terms of sort of the nuts and bolts of how it would actually work in saying an expert comes, are you arguing for a sort of a, somebody would stand to be elected as the health councillor or the or the schools councillor or that sort of thing? Is that kind of the logic?
Yes. At this stage, it's a broad principle, because remember my starting point is why aren't governments investing more in local government? Mm. Well, they never have done to any great extent, or at least for a very, very long time they haven't. And so I would like to see people from a whole range of skills just to come and be part of it. How it would be a little bit like an elected cabinet, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought through every last detail of it. It's a principle at this stage. It's to say, look, here's a direction of travel that we could go. The current national government is looking at it more at elected mayors, and particularly in this area, and that would seem to be the way we're going. And I think that could be better than the current system. But I'm still concerned that it's still not right. I use an example in my paper of Chatham Docks. And I know that the leader of Medway Council does not want to see Chatham Docks close at heart, you know, but he feels, as far as I can tell, I mean, it's for him to answer, of course, but as far as I can tell, he feels he has no other option. I would argue I don't think he has a team around him of people that have been able to argue that. And I also would say that the previous administration take a lot of that blame too, because that journey started a very long time ago. And if I'd been there, I would have certainly been fighting tooth and nail to save Chatham Docks, because it's an area I understand a little bit better than many others. And that's the sort of thing I'd like to see more in local government, so that people can see someone there who they respect for their background, whether it's private or public sector. They respect for their skills, their achievements, and that these people are putting everything they can into making the area better. I believe then national governments will say, well, actually, yeah, these people seem to know how to grow this area. They seem to know which industries should be where. They've got a very vibrant local plan, and so on and so forth. It becomes a virtuous circle. They will start to be looking at, well, where should hospitals be? Or what do we do about primary health care? What about social services? There are more efficient ways of delivering them. Mm. But that requires a lot of expertise. Some of it exists within the councils. I'm not saying officers don't have many of those skills, but we also need it from the elected side as well.
Do you think that an element of this is the political aspect, the fact that, you know, at the local level there is the Conservative Party and the Labour Party and the Lib Dems and all that sort of thing? Do we need to take local councils, make them apolitical? Because there'll be lots of people who, you know, don't consider themselves a diehard Tory or a diehard Labour supporter, but who don't want to get involved in sort of slanging matches about, you know, the national government. They just want to sort out their local area.
Do you know what? I have no problem with that at all. The problem with that, though, is that would be to change from where we are to going towards that. So I'm not dyed-in-the-wool conservative in the sense that they're the only people that get things right. Far from it. Of course they get things wrong, and a lot of other parties get a lot of things right. And I think in local government, my experience over the years I was there was there's far more agreement between councillors of all parties than there is disagreement on most matters. And so I think you're onto something, and it could be possible to have independent people on an elected cabinet. But at this stage, I'd be open to thinking, well, they could be a member of a party where they bring with them some values that people recognise, or they may not. But what the heart of it is to get the right people making the big decisions.
It seems to me quite a novel concept. I don't know of other places that do, for example, this elected cabinet thing. And it seems to me that it's, you know, quite openly a proposal to make, to change the purpose of local government from a one of democratic representation to one more of technocratic management of public services. But it also seems to me that whether it, that in that way, it's also quite anti-political, the idea that local problems can be solved simply by having a small number of the right kind of smart people making the right kind of decisions to solve our problems. It seems to me that there are institutional reasons why these kinds of people have not arisen naturally through the processes of politics to govern local councils effectively. And surely that means the primary problem is not necessarily the structure of local government, but one's political parties. Political parties, including your own, have become so divorced from the public that not enough people are joining them locally, not enough people stand for them locally. And like you say, if you're the kind of person who sincerely wants to change your area, whether you have strong political views or not, why wouldn't you just go to the private sector? This seems to me to sort of ignore the elephant in the room, which is the question is political parties, unless you concede that you just don't think they should have any role in local government.
No, I'm not saying they shouldn't have any role. I hope I'm clear that I think that could go either way. I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I think at this stage, all we need to do is to try and get good people making decisions and for them to be accountable to the public along with the ideas and proposals that they put forward. And when I joined, despite my background, the first thing they asked me to do was to be on Children and Young People's Overview and Scrutiny Committee. Well, you know, of all the things that I had skills on, it certainly wasn't that particular area. Although I embraced it because, wow, here's something new to learn. But could I contribute much? Probably not. My whole life has been trying to help organisations succeed, to find out why they're not succeeding, and to try and help them to get the very best people in the best positions to make the best decisions. This is not, what I'm suggesting is not going to solve all the problems. Of course it's not. I mean, I live in the real world. And local government is always going to have to follow the laws and the rules set by national government. I mean, that's a huge part of it, always will be. What I'm saying is, at a local level, and every geographical, shall we call it, community of interest, it has got its own opportunities and its own problems, and we need people with the skills to recognise those and to really be able to drive them forward. And without trying to rubbish any councillors anywhere in the county, all I'm saying is we could do better. And to do that, we'd have to pay them a little bit more. Sorry, the other point is this, behind what you're saying. I mean, at the time I was a councillor, I think the basic allowance was about 10 or 11,000. I was a retired person with a pension. That was okay for me. For some people who, you know, are sort of got a young family, they've got a mortgage to pay, it's just not possible to do that. And in the middle of my career, I'll be honest, my head, I mean, took an interest like most people in what was going on around me, but I wasn't in a place to suddenly give up everything I was doing and walk into that. I've often joked with people, if anyone criticises me, and believe it or not, it happens, I said, well, the reason you got me is because you didn't stand. And it's as simple as that. And to get people to stand, we've got to put something there where they feel excited and interested to do so.
Similarly, on those lines, I mean, remuneration is obviously a major part of, you know, as you say, people don't want to take a career break to, or, you know, give up their evenings when they've got a young family or whatever it might be. Do you think there's also an element of it that local councils aren't as, well, we're seeing a little bit change with the devolution, but the powers they have, for example, the local authorities used to be in charge of schools and they're less so now because of the changes with the academy system. A lot of people have this perception, whether right or wrong, because obviously they do adult social care, which is a massive, massive part of local government, but that the council basically collects your bins, cuts the grass, doesn't really have that much, you know, it doesn't control transport, for example. Are these things that with devolution possibly will make local government more interesting? Because people say, well, you can do whatever you want in local government.
Well, yes, I mean, that's the direction of travel. But by the way, transport, of course, is included in local government. They have a lot to do in that, but they, of course, don't run the national highways networks or the national rail service and so on. But you mentioned schools. During the lifetime of many of your listeners, as you rightly observe, schools have gone from being all run by the local authority to a completely different system. And I have to ask myself, well, maybe had people had more confidence in the way that the local authority was running the educational system, because we had an expert there, or experts who really were able to translate national policy into something really effective locally, then maybe that wouldn't have happened. I remember going back to my BT days, it was one of the first big businesses to be sold off. It was, as most people know, it was the GPO, then the post office, and then it was all sold off many years ago. And I was there when all that was going on. And I had to think to myself, well, why is that happening? It was happening because people didn't have confidence in the monopoly as it was and the way it was being run. And so therefore, there was this huge change that came about. And the better we can run things, the more confident we are the way they're run, the less likely we are to interfere with them. And so, again, it comes back to, it's not the panacea that's going to solve every problem, but if we're able to raise the standard locally and encourage more really qualified, great people, then maybe we could start to see better investment decisions.
As Rob mentioned, the government is, you know, there's huge local government reforms that are happening at the moment. And as part of that, the total number of councillors across the whole of England, but particularly in Kent, is going to be reduced very significantly. They'll have more responsibility as part of these unitary councils, presumably meaning they'll probably end up getting a higher allowance. So do you think, you know, even if it's not perfect, do you think maybe the reform of local government with less councillors, with more responsibility and more time, is a step in the right direction?
I think it is, yeah. And I think that's a fair point. I would still like to look at the details of that. I'd like to see how it plays out. If as these changes are implemented, it encourages more people to become part of that, then that could be good. And I go back to one of my earlier points, is that, or at least I wrote it in the paper, is that all parties struggle to get good people to stand for election. And that's no criticism of any party, regardless of the size of their membership. It is very, very difficult. So the more we can do to improve that opportunity, the better for the country as a whole.
Stuart Tranter, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chancellor Rachel Reeves announced on Wednesday the government's intention to end the policy of housing asylum seekers in hotels by the end of this parliament, which could be as far away as 2029. Rob, why have they done this and what will happen now instead?
Asylum hotels are a sort of a massive element that sort of attracts lots of ire from people all across the country. So it's entirely logical that they want to get rid of this as sort of a totem of the problem of asylum and illegal immigration and all that sort of thing. So what they plan to do is, from my understanding, is invest in the processing of the people who come and claim asylum and come to this country, to get through that backlog quicker. Because basically the reason why these people are in these asylum hotels is because they are just waiting for results of whether their asylum claim will be approved or denied. And then there's obviously the complications that go on with what happens after they've been denied. So I think this is a very sensible proposition from the government, in terms of this has kind of always been the answer all along. There have, you know, as part of austerity, the immigration services were not immune to the cuts from the previous government. And so staff numbers of people processing the applications of asylum seekers went down. So obviously the backlog grew, as it does in sort of across all government departments. And that's why we see the extent of the people in the asylum hotels that we have done. So I think if Labour are serious about this and really do amp up the amount of people and try to get to where they say they are, which is basically as soon as somebody arrives in the UK, they are processed. And if they win asylum, then they get to stay. And if they don't, then they move on to the next step. Then it's entirely plausible that they could get to closing the asylum hotels by the end of this parliament.
Dan, in the public's mind, those seeking asylum are all coming across on the small boats, but it's far more complex than that, isn't it?
Yeah, obviously, many people who come over on small boats and arrive in Kent then go on to claim asylum. But quite a lot of illegal immigration and asylum claims this country actually, you know, originate with what is technically perfectly legal means. I've mentioned this on the podcast before when covering, for example, illegal working in licensed premises. A lot of time what people will do is come over on working holiday visas or short-term work visas or student visas. There are a lot of universities which are very open to accepting students from abroad, regardless of the transferability or relevance of their qualifications. And then once you find a legal way of getting into the country, claim asylum, because it seems to be treated like an open secret that once you get into the asylum system, once you have a claim lodged, the legal architecture available to you of putting in more asylum claims and appealing and that kind of thing almost guarantee your ability to stay in the country pretty much indefinitely, and especially if you can find housing or whatever, just sort of disappear into the black economy. So it's not just people on small boats who are responsible for asylum claims, but they are a large proportion.
So in a word, do you think this will work?
No, probably not, because of precisely that thing I mentioned, that part of the reason why the government is so burdened with finding long-term housing for people who claim asylum is because of the very nature of the asylum system and the legal infrastructure around it, is that you can claim asylum. If it's rejected, you can appeal. You can appeal, as far as I can tell, nearly indefinitely your asylum claims. And the problem is all of this sort of, while it's a major public issue that a lot of people care about and it costs an awful lot of money, all of this is a way of avoiding the central legal, political, moral question embodying questions of asylum seeking, which is international human rights law up to scratch, and is it in line with what the vast majority of voters want? I think the answer is clearly not. As long as we have a system of international human rights law where citizens of any state can basically claim asylum in any other state, because under extremely broad grounds, there will always be a huge market of people trying to come into this country to claim asylum because we enjoy a brilliant standard of life here relative to most of the rest of the world. So basically, the only way the government will ever end up not having to house huge numbers of people who are pending asylum claims is if they, for example, withdraw from the ECHR or rewrite our local interpretation of the European Declaration of Human Rights to make it so long we no longer have those responsibilities to people. And I somehow don't imagine that the government really has the appetite for that.
Thanks both. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan and Matt for their contributions. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, especially our new column, KCC Insider, and you can find that at kentonline.com/politics. You can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.